beginning Monday here on Stereo 105. And listen to KUAC FM 105 this Tuesday at 9 for all election night returns. Besides local coverage, up-to-the-minute national and statewide reports will bring you the latest developments in all the important contests. Don't miss election evening coverage, Tuesday at 9, here on Stereo 105. This is KUAC FM in Fairbanks. It's now 11 o'clock, and time for the Home Fires Radio Show.
Good morning on this chilly Saturday morning, and welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. I hope you're all home enjoying your fire. With me in the studio today are David Hedberg and C.B. Bettesworth. We're going to have something that isn't exactly a typical topic for home fires, although we range so far, it's sort of hard to say what is typical. We're going to talk about the whole concept of planning and zoning in the Fairbanks North Star Borough and planning and zoning in general. They are trying to get as much public opinion of our community's needs as possible. And so I am happy to share my radio audience with David and CB. Our number is 474-5044, and I strongly encourage you throughout the discussion this morning to join in with your questions and your opinions. This is an excellent opportunity in the comfort of your own home to participate in this zoning and planning discussion. 474-5044. David, let's start with you. You are new to Fairbanks, just 3 weeks, and you are the new
Borough Planning Director.
Could you share with us first a little bit about your background? Where do you come from? And
I have roughly 12 years' experience in planning, a couple of graduate degrees and a couple of undergraduate degrees in related fields. I'm originally from Tennessee. Uh-huh. Just prior to moving to Fairbanks, I was located in Northern California, where I was the planning director for Siskiyou County, which is right on the Oregon border. Uh-huh. And I've done private consulting work as well.
Okay, and we'll get some general information about CB, and then we'll go back into a little more detail.
I've been around Fairbanks most of my life. Mm-hmm. Grew up here, went to high school here, grade school. Took a degree in architecture, came back and worked as an architect in Fairbanks for 4 or 5 years. Was on the Planning and Zoning Commission, got interested in planning, decided to take a planning degree at the University of Washington. Did some planning in Ketchikan for 3 years with the planning department there. Decided that maybe I'd like to get back into architecture, so I opened my own architectural practice and have been doing that since. And this actually represents the first community planning project that I've been involved in since that time. I think what got me going on the project was the fact that the borough just adopted the comprehensive plan in March of 84, and that the project that we're involved in, which is rewriting the zoning ordinance, picks up where the comp plan left off and implements the comp plan, which was an experience that we completely missed out on in Ketchikan. We wrote the comp plan, but we weren't there when they were to go redo the zoning ordinance, which actually they never did do. So today, for this project, for us, is really exciting.
Because you get to participate in the entire thing from the beginning to the end, and hopefully that'll be a more coherent plan. Is that the...
Well, I guess that's part of it, but also it's we get to see the implementation portion.
I see. Okay. Before we get into a specific discussion about the North Star Borough and Fairbanks, I would really like to talk about the whole sort of concept of planning and zoning. We have a national capital that had a very rigid plan, and so that there are some American cities, especially some older ones, that had a real guiding idea behind them in terms of street layout and what areas would serve what purposes. So would you care to talk about the concept of why planning is good, some of the history of city planning?
Yes, first of all, the key to any, keep in mind what we're doing now, the purpose of discussion is the zoning ordinance. As CB indicated, the zoning ordinance is the police power, the actual tool that implements your long-range plan for the growth of the city, which is called the comprehensive plan. The comprehensive plan has already been adopted by the Borough Assembly, and it sets forth the future growth pattern of how Fairbanks and the Fairbanks North Star Borough will be growing into the future. One thing to remember about planning, especially, is that it is not a static concept. It is truly dynamic. It is changing constantly. A future plan for growth that was prepared and adopted today, in 5 years may be coming out of date. In a couple of years may come out of date. For example, when we are through with the zoning ordinance, one of the things we want to be looking at is take a look at the comprehensive plan, see if we want to do an additional rewrite.
But isn't that the whole point of planning, is that one can do some projection out into
the future?
Correct. I mean, that's so that it
that's
isn't higgledy-piggledy and
that is correct. That
there is some kind of coherence.
That is correct.
So obviously a plan that was devised in 1915 wouldn't necessarily be appropriate
exactly.
in 1948 because you can't anticipate what changes entirely might have happened.
Exactly.
But there are some things. I mean, this is not something that you just make up out of your head. There are some
right.
rules for planning.
Right.
There are some concepts.
I think you have to remember what the what the comprehensive plan represents. It represents the policies of your elected officials as to how the community will grow in the future. On every street, every corner, every alley, it's the policy of how things will grow in the future. You're correct. You can't. Things do change, and that's the reason the planning process is a dynamic one.
Okay, but I still do want to get back to a more general discussion first about planning. In the United States in the 1940s, 1950s, towns had central downtown areas mm-hmm. That people could access with buses or by walking. Their schools were, in general, fairly close to their homes, and the theory was that children could walk to grade schools at least from their homes. Then we entered the freeway pattern where we developed suburbs, and the whole suburban concept came in. Now, bear in mind, I'm just a lay person on this subject. I'm just giving you my sort of overview, and then I want you to react to this. We got to the suburban concept, and then came all of the drive-in facilities and shopping malls, which really had very serious negative impact on a lot of traditional downtown areas, and especially when we went to interior malls and so on. Then at that time, it seemed particularly ironic to me that we had a gas shortage. And people were told, don't drive so much at a time when we had our entire towns organized around driving. And if you decided not to drive, you simply couldn't do your business, whether it be banking or cleaning or anything else. And it became much more difficult to maintain and operate orderly public transportation systems with that sort of spread out concept. And, of course, busing had the busing legislation had an impact on the way the schools were organized. So I want to talk about it in that way. And there were a lot of city planners involved in those plans, and there's been a lot of problems getting keeping downtown areas from.
Yeah. The planning business is, or the planning issues are. They don't just deal with the things that necessarily have to do with the borough planning department or a community planning department, county, whatever it is. When I went to school at Washington, it was real interesting. They had just rolled that school out of being mostly what we would define in the architecture practice as urban design, or what's currently defined as urban design, or physical planning issues. They had rolled into being involved in social planning, economic planning, health planning, all that kind of stuff, generic planning, transportation planning. Well. And it's like you say, what you basically do is you do a group of studies, you find out what the current situation is. Like, for instance, with land, you look at land use, you look at what the projections might be in terms of increased population, increased use, that kind of thing, what appropriate uses might be located in an area, and then make some projections and sort of test those with the community. But there are things that happen, forces within the society that are larger than just dealing with the issue of land use. I think a real good example that the country has learned from is the issue of highway planning. Seattle is a place that I'm fairly familiar with, and there are freeways that stop in midair in Seattle because the people finally says, wait, the kinds of issues that generated these highways or the ideas for these highways are no longer relevant in Seattle, or we don't think they're relevant in Seattle. Let's relook at this idea. And I think they did relook at it. And another thing that's happened is as you point out, back after World War II, the federal government got very energetic in assisting the financing of single-family housing. Uh-huh. The FHA program provided 3% loans to anybody, well, not anybody, but and with very low down payments for the whole population. Consequently, you get places like Los Angeles where there's just fields and fields and fields, miles and miles of housing that's all single family. Behind that then came the federal highway program that built the freeways. And then behind that came the malls. Those were public policies that were not community planning policies necessarily. Those were actions upon which community planners didn't have any control. And then what's happened since in terms of downtowns, you brought up the issue, and I wanted to carry this a little bit farther. So what happened is there was this suck of people out of downtown, the economic enterprise in the downtown area.
To clarify that point, that was because of available loan money for single-family dwellings followed by federal dollars for highway programs.
Right.
Is that what you're saying? That's so you're saying there's very little community input in that whole movement.
Yeah.
Okay,
and
I just want to make...
So like in the Seattle issue where they came along and they stopped the freeways, they said, well, we're going to change that policy here.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple other things have happened, tight money in housing markets and that kind of thing is changing some of those policies. But then another interesting thing has happened since. The idea of the downtown has changed. The downtown is now a financial center. It's an office core area. Our information processing part of the society or portion of society is grown greatly from what it was back in the 40s. So that's then changing the whole character of what the downtown is like.
At those businesses being banks, mortgage companies,
professional offices,
stock companies, lawyers.
Yeah. Let me use another example. You gave a good overview of the history, I guess, of modern planning, per se. You mentioned one of the problems during the growth boom of the 50s when they had urban sprawl. There was a propensity for people to want to live away from their work. Today, for example, people are wanting to live closer to the work. That's, for example, one of the things we're doing in the new rewrite of the zoning ordinance. We're going to be allowing residential uses in commercial zones where previously they weren't allowed. The thrust, of course, is to get people closer to the workplace.
So you have less commuting traffic.
That's correct. That's correct. Also, air quality, things on top of that are helped. The problem with sprawl right now is kind of a twofold issue. The first one was it didn't cost very much to build infrastructure, such as sewer, water, streets. Hmm. So everybody just went ahead and built, no problem, sprawl. But then all of a sudden, the cost of maintaining the infrastructure started to hit local government. Therefore, local government finally has figured out that they cannot afford to build in a sprawl-like manner without having to pay the cost down the line.
Okay, let me clarify that. What you're saying is that initial capital investment has been or is affordable, but the maintenance dollars, the operating dollars... are the things that are hard to acquire and hard to fund.
That's correct, because that comes out of the taxpayer pocket.
Okay.
You know, a good example of that is I used to work for the city of San Jose. We had I saw growth down there that was beyond anything that's probably been seen up here. It was right at the tail end of the big growth boom. One of the things the city was starting to find out was that, all these nice requirements that were being put in, such as sidewalks, sewer and sidewalks, neighborhood parks, And all those things were just fine and wonderful, but all of a sudden they found out they didn't have the money to maintain the neighborhood parks and, you know, keep their sidewalks maintained. I was getting to the second reason why sprawl took off. If you remember the Sears, the old Sears Roebuck houses, little postage stamp lots they used to have with these 4,000, mm-hmm. I think it's even 4,000 square foot lots.
Mm-hmm.
Well, during the 50s, everybody wanted these large 10,000 square foot lots. And it's just amazing how much land that eats up when you're dealing with, you know, hundreds of thousands of housing units.
Mm-hmm. So the amount of land changed dramatically because that was with the advent of the riding mower.
Exactly right.
And a lot of it probably had nothing to do with community planning.
And
how the minute we had electric mowers, we could mow more grass, and therefore it didn't matter. You could have a bigger yard. Very impressive.
Subsequently, you're finding a lot of the cities, that had these growth problems, going back and re-subdividing their large lots, or going back to allowing much smaller lots to be created in the central core, where you don't have that push for outward growth as bad as you would without the large lots.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm always amazed with the amount of money that we put into planning, with the amount of education that planners are required to have. I mean, there are PhDs in planning now, and CB, you described a really varied background with a lot of information, obviously, that you've gained not only in your work experience but in your schooling, that it's so hard for us to anticipate a change of directions. For example, sidewalks. I mean, that is a good thing to talk about.
In Fairbanks.
And really anywhere. When I was growing up in the 50s, sidewalks were a used piece of concrete. People walked up and down, walked to school and so on. Now, there's much less foot traffic in a lot of neighborhoods and in a lot of areas, and that may, in fact, be an unnecessary addition. However, bike paths are becoming something that many communities really want, to get that bike traffic, especially for young people, off of the actual roadway where motor vehicles are operating makes a lot of sense. And that, of course, requires a totally different thing than the old sidewalks with curbs every... why is it so hard for us to anticipate these kinds of...
The kinds of changes.
In a more timely fashion, so that we're not constantly laying out asphalt and digging it up and putting down concrete and digging it up. I mean, I've seen a lot of that go around on in Fairbanks, even in the 5 years I've been here.
Hmm. I mean, how do you keep from...
Why?
Well, some of the...
She's talking about the anticipation. How can we anticipate the kinds of things that might be happening to us? I think we try, to the extent possible, we try to show... one of the things that we did in Ketchikan I thought was pretty interesting is we tried to describe to the people there the impacts of the public policy decisions that were currently in place, and describe to them also then what the what options were available to them with respect to what those impacts were, to either to take care of them, to reduce the impacts. And actually, what we like to do there was to talk not so much about talk about the impacts, but also talk about what are the possibilities, what's the opportunities, what are the things, how can you do this nicely. And again, this, my background is in land use planning. I'm really a physical type person. I like the business of waving my wand and have something happen. I don't like to wave the wand a whole bunch and not have a lot happen. I'm kind of active. So a lot of the stuff I'm going to use is going to be from that kind of a background. I think an area that the United States, in terms of physical planning issues, is not thinking about yet, but I think is going to have an impact, is the whole idea of computers, computer information, at-home computers, and what kind of impact is that going to have on the way we live. And it's not going to just affect... it's going to affect how we drive, where we drive to, how we get our goods, all that kind of thing.
For example, if you can do your banking from your home.
That's right.
Or obviously these computer tellers that are already happening all over town make driving to the bank a much less frequently required trip. Mm-hmm. Is that the kind of thing
Sure.
you're talking about?
There's a time coming, and not very far future where you can take a modem in your at-home computer and install your deposit and have it recorded at the bank and not ever have to go bother to go down there.
Okay.
The answer to your question very directly, though, is that the comprehensive plan is the vehicle where that is accomplished. If you have a good comprehensive plan, you're not always reacting. You're planning ahead. You know specifically what's going to be going down the road. There's always going to be changes. There's no doubt about that. But keep in mind, the comp plan is the guide that does it. That is the vehicle to accomplish what you're talking about.
Okay. We're talking about this comp plan. This is the comprehensive plan. What kind of factors do we take into consideration when we design a comprehensive plan?
There's a multitude of factors. Circulation, in other words, transportation, existing land use patterns, environmental considerations, the whole raft of environmental considerations, the location of different types of other public infrastructure.
What's other public infrastructure mean?
Things like services, I'll say, for example, telephone services, sewer and water, so on. Looking at and what the comp plan does based on this multitude of factors, what's the best land use pattern that you know should occur for Fairbanks in the future? For example, Washington, D.C. Was designed by a French architect. It was merely a spoke pattern. So
mm-hmm.
A very simple, straightforward design that works very well.
It still does work very well.
Because it was followed very specifically. The problem with planning in the the American spectrum is that it's such a highly volatile and a highly political process, and it makes the decision-making process very, very rough. It's the old thing of some people say, well, regulate my neighbor, but don't regulate me. That puts the decision-makers in a very, very tough bind. So, but as I'm saying, that's where it's not just as simple as laying down the plan and doing it just the way the plan says. It's a problem.
I guess that is a little bit what I want to talk about, is that we have to make some really very large assumptions to do planning. One of the things that came to my mind when you were talking about your modem at home, that presumes that you're in an economic category to have a modem at home. And
right.
If we do city planning based on those people who will have modems at home, what about those people who don't have modems at home? And in what way has that planning adversely affected their access to whatever they need?
There's another thing here that we get to talk about Washington, D.C. Dave is exactly right. Washington, D.C. was done by an architect, and he did it by himself. And he put it down on paper, and then he said, and the government owned the land, and they says this is the way it's going to be done. That's a lot different than Fairbanks today, where there's lots of people on lots of different land, and they're not going to allow me to go down there and say this is where the way it's going to be. That it's a community process now. It's not a single individual's decision.
Right, right. And there are advantages and disadvantages to both of those things.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Back to the comprehensive plan so we don't get too far afield. When was the comprehensive plan devised?
CB, I'm a newcomer. I'm going to CB answer analyst.
We have to go back to the...
In fairness to David, he's only been here 3 weeks.
Yeah, right. Roughly about a year ago, is that correct?
Okay, the one that we currently have before us is the one that's recently been adopted was 1984.
Right.
It began in the planning process, I think, approximately 2 years before that. During that time, the process itself, the process itself included a whole group of neighborhood workshops. I think there was a series of three in 20 different locations.
And they were well attended?
We weren't part of that process. My understanding is
they were well attended. My understanding of that was, yeah.
They were reasonably well attended. They have, depends on what you call well attended, we've been holding community workshops too. And we think that there's a fair amount of people show up at these things, and they're well-informed, and they have things to say. But they always say, Jiminy Christmas, there sure would have been a lot more people here if this had happened or if this had happened or something like that. You really aren't hearing from the whole community. But not everybody can get to every one of these things.
Well, it depends on whether your toes are being stepped on or whether you anticipate that your toes are going to be stepped on as to how serious your motivation is. Okay. So you had a series of community workshops in 20 locations, three each location, and you took testimony from the citizens of Fairbanks that told you what they...
This is on the zoning ordinance, not what CB's referring to.
No, that was on the comp plan.
Oh, comp plan.
Yeah, comp plan. And actually, I don't think that should be characterized that there was testimony taken. They were really workshops. There were situations where, again, I think that the consulting team in the borough went out and said, here's what we see. Let's hear what you want to do, that kind of thing. Okay. And then they went back and says, well, this is what we heard. This is what we think you need to do here. What do you think of that? And they say, well, all right, that's fine. And they went back and revised it, and they came back again the third time. And then the other process, and then an adjunct to that was when that process was completed and the plan was developed, it was submitted to the Planning Commission for adoption and approval.
Who is on the Planning Commission? Are those appointed?
They're appointed members. It's a
current, mayor.
Yeah, 11-member body. They held a round of public hearings. These were testimony-type hearings, come in and say what you think of the way this thing is developed. They made some modifications, and then they passed it on to the Assembly, who is the final authority on this. And the Assembly then had another round of public hearings, and then at that time it was... They made additional modifications, and then that's when it was finally adopted in March.
Okay, so is this the first comprehensive plan that this borough has had?
No.
How often do we have a comprehensive plan?
I don't remember when the last one was, but...
It's been several years, but I think the last one prior to that was in existence for quite a few years. We're supposed to annually review it for update, so that's going to be going on as well.
Okay, but there's obviously this process that CB just described doesn't happen every year.
No.
This happens once every 10 years, just roughly?
No, it should be once every five.
At the very minimum.
The workshop, testimony, planning commission, assembly, vote, all of that should occur once every 5 years with yearly updates.
At the very minimum, 5 years.
Yeah. At the very minimum. Okay. Now I want to get down to some specifics. Could you first give us just a little summary of what are the actual contents of that comprehensive plan? I mean, what does it call for?
I can just briefly say it is a significant change from what the original comp plan did. Dave already mentioned one of them. One of the things they talk about is multi-use. The old comp plan and the current zoning ordinance is one in which there are very specific uses, discrete with respect to the type. Like, for instance, industrial land is industrial land, commercial land is commercial land, residential land is residential land, don't mix.
Each area is distinct and separate with one function and purpose only, and this is reflected in the zoning regulation, right?
Yeah.
And then zone commercial, you can only have commercial enterprises here and no...
Right. The new comp plan talks about that and says that there needs to be an allowance of multiple use.
Is this a trend nationwide?
Oh, yes.
I think so.
Multiple use areas.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I think that we've been that route. It doesn't work all the time.
The discrete
people,
route.
People are getting more creative with what they can do.
Kinds of architecture they incorporate in their businesses and so on. Let's talk a little bit about that old-fashioned discrete thing to set the stage. The feeling was that had a lot to do with real estate values. How discreet your neighborhood was. In other words, if it was a mixed neighborhood, your residential values would not be as high as they would be if it was a purely zoned residential area.
There was also the idea that there was a basic incompatibility between commercial uses, residential uses, commercial and industrial uses.
Based on what?
Based upon noise, traffic.
Aesthetics?
I'm not sure what the aesthetics.
I've read some studies on that. A lot of that, at first thought it was people's perception of multiple family housing is where undesirable folks lived. But they found out that it was really racist. Really, a lot of racism was involved in that. Mm. I think those type of things that supposedly degraded the cost of housing has gone down. For example, if apartment houses are well done, I don't think they have that severe an impact on a single family neighborhood per se. If they're well done, that's the big qualifier.
Well, in fact, we have, I gather that there is a national trend to zero lot line building, which would you like to explain that so I don't mash this up for you? An absolute change in direction from that larger and larger big yard where you need a riding mower. Now, because land costs in so many places are really high, in order to get a very attractive, high-quality finished house, people are willing to sacrifice on land. And, in fact, in people's busy lives, they're less likely to want to do major yard upkeep. And so you have shared, you have basically private dwellings with private separate entrances, but they're designed so that they share a common wall. And we had a lot of zoning that you had to be, all structures had to be set back so many feet in all directions from the lot line. And now there is zero lot line, I assume, means that there has to be much less space between the edge of the lot and the structure.
Go ahead, Stephen.
There was another component to the issue of we're talking about residences in the single family situation. There was also this problem of fire protection, and that's another way in which the zoning got involved in protecting basically public health and safety.
So if my house catches on fire, if it's a certain distance away, I'm not going to impact the next one.
In what's happened in the interim, and we're talking about back in the 20s and 30s, in the interim now there's been basically adoption of national building codes. They're not all applicable in Alaska, and they're not all applicable with single-family housing. But the minute you do get involved in multiple-family housing, they kick into gear. And the state of Alaska basically is the one that does that enforcement. So then the concerns that used to be there about single-family housing or attached housing, attached, not detached, single-family housing are no longer so critical.
Mm-hmm. And we are seeing also nationwide a real trend toward condominium buying.
That's correct. That's once again land costs. Well, that CB did bring up a potential problem. One of the things you have to watch, and I philosophically like the idea of increasing density in the central city, you mentioned for one of the reasons the cost of land. However, if you don't have a building code situation, I don't care where you are, you're talking about a relatively dangerous situation to start increasing density, because for example, one structure catches on fire, it's going to affect your neighbors.
Okay, let's talk about a building code situation. Let's talk about a building code situation. What do you mean by a building code situation?
Well, I mean, for example, in the city of Fairbanks, they have a building code. It would regulate the structure. In the outlying areas, they do not. See, the density in the outlying areas is not anywhere near as in the new zoning ordinance rewrite. The density out there won't be the same as it was in the city. It will be less dense.
Okay. I have had some programs in the past that sort of dealt with construction in Fairbanks, and we've all agreed that it's quite irregular in many instances, and that picture may be, in fact, changing and evolving as our economy changes and evolves. But we have a tradition here where people are building on land that, because they didn't have access to normal plumbing systems or electricity, it was not possible for them to get normal bank financing. And therefore, you get on the board-a-month plan, and if you're going to do a board-a-month, then you're going to build your own way. And it can get very creative. I had some people on here talking about plumbing and heating, and they were just laughing about the odd systems. Now, sometimes that creativity causes us to get really ingenious solutions that have a lot of benefits. And, of course, sometimes it's just downright dangerous. And it's hard. I mean, everyone thinks theirs is okay and everybody else's isn't. All right, so what you're saying is that some of those things, when they are not, in fact, demonstrably safe, if they are on low-density land, if you have 10 acres, if your dwelling is unsafe, then that is your personal problem. But when we're in a high-density area in downtown area where a danger that you have by not following coding may impact your neighbor's properties and welfare— Then we need to come in as a government and say, wait a minute.
Right.
Okay.
That's basically correct.
All right. Now, traditionally, would you say, or not traditionally, but in fact, has Fairbanks been fairly lax in having a lot of codes until fairly recently? Or
well, the current situation is that there isn't a building code in the borough area. In fact, the only place that there's building codes in effect are in the municipalities where the UBC, basically Uniform Building Code, which is the one the state of Alaska has adopted, where those municipalities have adopted those codes and put them into effect. This municipality, the Fairbanks North Star Borough, has not done that. There's one little kicker to this.
Well, the
bank has some interest in this.
Right.
As I indicated earlier, the state of Alaska, through the state fire marshal's office, does implement and enforce the UBC for what they describe as public-type facilities or public-use-type facilities and for larger-scale residential projects. I can't remember just exactly what the definition is there. I mean, there is a scale at more than 4 units or something like that. And they do come in. You're required to go get a building permit. You're required to have the inspections, that kind of thing.
So if the public is coming to your building, or if it's going to be rental property so that the individual doesn't have control over it, then it is controlled. But if it's just you building your house out somewhere in the borough, then it's up to you.
Of course, the question of do we have enough ordinances or not, the major issue is the zoning ordinance. It depends on who you talk to, I think. Some people think we have too many. Some people think we don't have enough. That's the unanswerable question, I think.
Okay. Audience, our number is 474-5044. If I'm not asking all the questions you want to ask, please call in and join us, 474-5044. All right. I guess what has been clearly established here this morning is that it's a real complex problem, and it's a complex issue that has a lot of directions that it needs to be examined from. I mean, one is the issue of personal and public safety of property and limb. One is what direction is the town going?
Aesthetics, quality of life.
Of life. What kind of problems development in one area might create for another area? I started, and we lost it, to ask you to describe in summary the basic plan for us. One of the things that you indicated in the letter was to me in advance of this program was that there. In that comprehensive plan, the community wanted commercial development to be in core areas.
Right.
All right. Now, that's not what I see when I drive around town. What I see is tremendous building in an artery way on College Road, on Airport. Airport has service roads, so that's a somewhat safer condition, but College is, in fact, an extremely dangerous roadway.
If I could answer that, as a matter of fact, that issue has come up quite a few times, and College Road is one of the areas that has a problem, also Geist Road.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems with that is that looking under the development goals for where you will and will not allow commercial in the comprehensive plan, this issue arose at the assembly meeting, I think it was about a week ago. The policies themselves are internally inconsistent. For example, they have a whole set of policies that indicate that commercial literally can go, for lack of a better word, the normal areas. But then right after that, it has a policy that says discourage strip commercial development. So the problem is, they're inconsistent with each other. Where do you go from here? This is the type of thing and the type of reason you need to revise and annually update the comprehensive plan when you have these internal inconsistencies.
I really want to understand this. Okay. We have gone through a very complex planning policy. I mean, we have planned our policy through a really complex series of events, workshops, public opportunities, and you're saying that the policy we've developed is very internally inconsistent.
The one referring to commercial development is very simple. You just read the policies 1 through 8, and then look at policy 9, which is inconsistent with all the others.
Okay, 1 through 8 says basically anywhere you want to build commercial.
Right. basically.
Establishment is okay, and then the next one says, wait a minute, we don't want strip development.
Perfect, right.
Okay, we have a caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I would like to ask if your guests are aware of the differences between zoning and land covenants.
Yes, we're aware.
Could you maybe explain that a little bit? How the difference would affect planning?
Well, a land covenant is basically a contract in the land that is exercised by the owner at the time he sells his property. A land use regulation that's established by the municipality is a regulation that's adopted by the assembly and can be changed by that assembly. The contract between individuals on the land is one that needs to be changed by those people as individuals, and normally takes a civil court procedure in order to get through it, unless you can amend the contract otherwise. And in fact, in order to enforce the covenant, you need to go through the civil court procedures in order to enforce it.
I'd like to add one thing on top of that. Let me use an example for you. Say, for example, a person wants to sell his piece of land, and he has a restriction, in the covenant saying that no mobile homes can be erected there. Demonstrate to you how complex it gets, and it's not as clear-cut as that, is that it used to be the legal line of thought that the only thing you in fact could not put a mobile home on that piece of land. But there have been recent court decisions where indicated that if government zoned that land and allowed mobile homes, even though you had a private covenant on that particular piece of property, you still could build it because the jurisdiction's zoning and police power says, yeah, you do have the right to build a mobile home. So it's not quite as cut and dried as that, but most of the times covenants merely relate to, as CB said, relate to the desires of the person that not wanting to allow certain types of things to be built.
And they have to be at least consistent with the zoning.
That private covenant versus what's allowed with zoning is absolutely one of the most complex legal issues I think I've ever seen in my career at all.
Isn't it Houston, Texas that works in that way, that they do not have zoning, but they do have land covenants?
Okay, Houston, Texas used to not have zoning. They had something similar to land covenants. Houston, Texas is, as a matter of fact, right in the middle of drafting a zoning ordinance because the city is literally a mess right now. They have streets going down the middle. They have streets at dead end right in the middle of the business district. The skyscrapers running around. The traffic is a mess. People have absolutely no idea what's going to be built up beside them. As I said, Houston for many years did not have zoning, but I know for a fact they're in the process right now, if they haven't already adopted, of writing a zoning ordinance.
Okay. On another topic, mixing residential with commercial, isn't this better for crime because you have more eyes to watch things?
You mean a deterrent to crime?
Right.
That's an interesting point of view. I don't know. You might have to police officer about that, but that's an interesting point of view.
Meaning that businesses, when they're closed for the night, you still have neighbors there.
You still have people around, right?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh, and more irregular coming and going patterns. That's really clear that when we had those isolated suburbs with two people in the household working, there were neighborhoods that were totally deserted for a predictable 8 hours every single day, not one person at home on the street. That is an interesting idea.
Okay, so one other thing is... how is it going to affect, especially with the computers and things, and there's a lot of people now that have small businesses and things in their homes. How is that going to affect commercial and residential areas?
You want to tackle it?
Yeah. I can tell you what the way that there currently is allowed at-home businesses, but the size of those businesses are restricted, and that situation is going to continue with the new ordinance.
So it has to do with how much traffic your business would cause to come and go?
There'd be limitations, and for example, no signing, things that are looked offensive in a residential neighborhood, mm-hmm. these type of things, where we haven't really got that nailed down exactly what it's going to be. But small businesses such as the Avon person, and that type of thing will undoubtedly still be allowed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I really want to not to leave this tag in. We we have this comprehensive plan. It has policy 1 through 8 saying that commercial development can occur almost anywhere, in fact. And then we have part 9 that says, no, we want it in a core area. How did that happen?
I wasn't here. In all honesty, I think the thrust is in this is that it's the thrust is still to discourage strip commercial, but they want to look on things in a case by case basis. I'm having problems with it because there's no question about it is inconsistent with each other. I still think the thrust is away from strip commercial. However, you use the example of College Road, which is a prime example.
One of the things that this thing says, there's one of these statements that's fairly clear. It says, encourage urban and commercial malls and groups of stores within preferred commercial areas. Okay, so now there's people coming around saying, well, Geist Road or College Road or Airport Road are all preferred commercial areas because there's a high traffic count on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll say that's the justification under which we think that this land ought to be rezoned.
Exactly.
And then we go over and it says, discourage commercial strip development. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the conflict arises, and it's a problem not so much as an inconsistency within the plan, but a definitional problem. And that's what we're going to work out here, and that's part of what the zoning ordinance does then, is it makes those things, defines them, and makes them consistent.
And this is not a problem unique to Fairbanks by any means. This is really something that we've seen in a lot of towns in America where you get two or three strips that have all the fast food, and when they have the majority of the traffic, then it's really understandable that other businesses would want to develop along those areas because they have high visibility and also easy access. I mean, that is the theory. The problem is it creates tremendous traffic use on those roads. And in the case of College that I see is that we really don't have an entry or an exit lane there.
It's not a divided highway.
It's not a divided highway. There is not a service road. And the traffic going on and off of that, especially if you are on a business on the right-hand side and want to go the opposite direction, you must cross two lanes of traffic. And there aren't traffic signals that really create no traffic moments. Yeah. I don't know how you describe those.
Basically, left turn conflicts.
I would agree with CB. We are going to try to resolve some of these conflicts in the zoning ordinance rewrite, but let's face it, the Ice Road and College Road are not urban area commercial malls or groups.
Mm-hmm.
This is where the rewrite. I think this is where our update next year. We're going to be looking at reviewing the comprehensive plan. The important thing right now to us, though, the most important thing, of course, is the zoning ordinance rewrite. Mayor Allen has told me he wants this thing done for the building season, and we're pushing along to get this accomplished.
What I was going to say is, if you in fact have enough construction starts that sort of slip in before things are well defined, you have in fact already a situation that's almost self-defining. I mean, if you have so many commercial buildings already built along a certain area, then it's really hard to say that that's not a suitable commercial area because it already is in fact a commercial area.
That's correct. But well, I'm using the cow. We're talking about apples and oranges. I'm talking about the case of Geist Road.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Geist hasn't happened yet, but there's obviously some pressure to talk of Wendy's here and there.
I'd one other thing on top of that. Strip commercial seems to become a dirty word some reason.
It sounds nasty.
I don't know. I'm not really, at least my personal philosophy, I'm not opposed to strip commercial as long as it's done right. I've seen some strip commercial areas that are, as far as I'm concerned, look a lot nicer than some of the residential areas I've seen. Just the quality of design and everything. I guess, but once again, that's aesthetics. It's in the eyes of the beholder.
Mm-hmm. And aesthetics seemed clearly to change. What's amazing to me is the sort of inconsistency, the way that a lot of people feel that certain kinds of plastic, fast I don't care whether it's grocery stores or food, or that people sort of think that they look unpleasant or they aren't aesthetically pleasing, but in fact, tremendous amount of marketing dollars have been spent to figure out what appeals to people. And, you know, it's not for nothing that they have billions of golden arches, because they have decided that that is, in fact, a very beckoning image. They decided that sometime in the 60s when the development of that particular chain was occurring. So I guess we have some kind of conflict here.
Well, you know, if you want to deal with McDonald's a little bit, I think within even within McDonald's, you know, those people spend a lot of time thinking about marketing. And recently, one of the things that's happened in there is that they are completely changing their images in new stores throughout the country. And in fact, when they go to build a new store, they don't build the standard golden arches. They find out what that community looks like, and they've got a mm-hmm. stock plan over here that fits that community. They've got 10 different plans. Mm-hmm. Ten different. And basically, they're packaging their buildings now like they would package a product. And that building then fits with that new community.
So that architecturally, if it's in Santa Fe and it's an adobe structure, then all of a sudden there's McDonald's looking like an adobe whatever.
For example, PB, you're saying I was in a place in Southern California, was very well designed, a lot of wood exteriors. And I was looking for McDonald's, and I couldn't find it anywhere. I was driving by it, and they had brown trimmed golden arches. So.
Brown trimmed redwood golden arches. All right, I would be real remiss if I didn't ask you both this question: how and why is all of this phenomenal development occurring in Fairbanks? It's just incredible.
Well, there's a lot of reasons for it.
Why don't you give us a few?
we may have the possibilities, of course, of having a half an infantry division moving in here.
But that number has been sliding back and forth. First it's 10, now it's 2. Now they don't know if they're going to use some of the people that are already here, and maybe some of it will go to Anchorage. And
there's a variety of things. Of course, you have the Community Research Center for the borough is probably a good source of information on that, right? You have their book there. There's probably a variety of reasons. Pay scales in Alaska, opportunities. I think since the pipeline, Fairbanks, has almost become a self-perpetuating economy in and of itself. As I said, there's a variety of reasons.
Self-perpetuating economy.
In other words, by that, I mean, they have their own. The city truly has their own economy now, and it's getting bigger, I think. Do you have anything to add onto that at all? International airport helps.
But you know, that's. It seems to me now you're certainly the experts, and you're willing to, and I'm perfectly willing to have you tell me where I'm wrong on this. But a lot of that is state capital building dollars that are not necessary. I mean, fine. This year you build an airport. Next year you might, have a big school project. But one presumes, unless there is some real industry, whether it's soft or hard industry, to pay for those services, that there's an end to that. Now, I'm wrong on that, but
there's, in terms of perspective, I think there's been a couple of things happening, and I'm not sure that I know all this either. And, you know, you'll ask people, and they'll say, well, maybe this is happening, But from my perspective, I think that we're kind of unaware of, and we don't really think about, the $2, $4, $6 billion a year they spend on the North Slope as part of the process of developing that oil field. If you took just a small percentage of that amount of money that was going there, got dropped off in this community, it's a big impact on this community in terms of employment, in terms of supplies that are provided, and that kind of thing. That oil field is generating an economy in Fairbanks. I think that there's a migration of people from, well, people who are oil field workers or oil-related workers who work on the slope, come back and live in communities in Alaska. Originally, I think there was a lot of those people moved to Anchorage. I think a lot of those people decided they don't like Anchorage. They'd rather live in Fairbanks if come to Fairbanks. And then I think also that in the past, Fairbanks, in the pipeline years, it just went, boom, took off. But the retail base or the commercial sector did not go with it. It in fact, it was overloaded. It didn't quite work right. Then, of course, right after the pipeline years and all the people were gone, everybody was scared. They were afraid to go ahead with the retail development, and people continued to purchase outside of the Fairbanks economy. So basically, Fairbanks has been under-retailed, and so what's happening now is that latent demand is catching up. People see where that market is, and they're starting to respond to the market.
Okay, so you were saying that if I can summarize or make it clear to myself and maybe clear to the audience, that it's partly a product of some optimism after the perhaps pessimism that occurred just immediately post-pipeline building. And it's also really serving a retail demand that has been in existence for, say, 5 years, and an economy that could support that retail demand, but just it wasn't here. In other words, I really want to buy my clothes in Fairbanks, but there weren't that many options for me to do so, or whatever specialty product. Now we're having a lot of little specialty stores, interior decoration and so on and so forth, that just weren't even here 5 years ago. So you're saying that in some ways it's a response to a demand that's been here for for a while,
right.
5 years, let's say.
I'm constantly, being new here, hearing people say all the time, wish we had more restaurants, do that, you know, more places and more varieties for us, shopping for clothes. I think that falls right in line with what CB was saying. I think there's a lot more things, too, probably, that people would like to hear if you're in the service industry-related field.
Mm-hmm. More choices, more competition.
More choices of everything, not just food and clothing.
It was when I first came here, the rental market was really tight. Mm-hmm. There were very few houses on the market for rent, or apartments or condominiums. And when one did, in fact, come available, it was simply snapped up. Now we may see a consumer market which is, you have a little more choice, because now we may have building to the point where you don't have to take just anything. And we're going to see some property sit a little bit.
We're overbuilt right now. I was reading an article in the paper indicating they didn't think that was going to be the current, that was going to last very long. But we'll see what happens.
Well, we have clearly some disadvantages here in terms of developing industry. Now, not tourism, but a product industry. We have a transportation cost. We have a cost of living cost that makes us, in terms of salaries, not highly competitive with a lot of other areas. We have some basic cost of living things that are not going to go away, the heating costs, lighting costs, and so on. And those really have to be factored in when we talk about unbridled development. Do you agree, or do you think we're going to have some technological breakthroughs that's going to make those issues obsolete? Or,
well, I think that there are other disadvantages, but I also think that Fairbanks is like other places in the world, is being impacted by a growing world population, and while people may not want to, are willing to live closer together in communities and in urban areas, people are moving away from central cities. The urban growth or suburban growth or even rural development growth in the United States is one of the things that is also going to change the face of the country. And industries and that kind of thing are showing up in those places. Fairbanks is one of those places where people will want to come.
Right.
It's a small community where people can have an impact and enjoy their life here.
Mm-hmm. Buckminster.
And as the population increases, the planning problems are going to increase. <long term.
laughs> Great.
Buckminster Fuller talked starting in the 50s about the fact that this need to be on the east, this bi-coastal theory that you needed to be in Washington, D.C. or New York or L.A. in order to have culture and in order to have access to things would become less and less
That's
a factor, and I think we're seeing that, and people are moving back to small towns. When I was growing up, everyone was fleeing the Midwest. When you graduated from college, you just left. Of course, it was a given, and a lot more people, I think, are staying. And Fairbanks, at 68,000 population in the North Star borough, is still a very manageable size. And so I think there are lots of good things that speak for it, quality of life being one of them. We've just got a few seconds. You are continuing this process. You're doing more hearings. Would you like to
give the pitch?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Right here.
The current process is that we are drafting the zoning ordinance. It will be submitted to the borough early next week for their review. After that, there will be a group of public hearings that will be held in which we will look at the outline for the draft, talk about what we're proposing, how it fits with the comp plan, how it fits with what we've heard from the community. Those meetings are going to be held. I didn't bring my schedule, but I think beginning in a week, about 10 days, and we'll continue up right about up to Thanksgiving.
And we'll be very well advertised in the paper.
Oh, yes, definitely.
And on
radio.
We
are also sending out individual flyers to every resident in the borough, as a matter of fact, notifying of the meeting schedules and the times and the dates.
Okay, and basically I would say your message is if you want to have to be involved with this process, the point to be involved with it is at the planning, not in the reactive stage after the zoning's been set.
That's very critical.
Okay, so they want you to speak now. You'll have an opportunity every year and every 5 years and so on. This is not a static process, but this is your chance between now and Thanksgiving to give your opinions. This has been Home Fires Radio Show. Thank you, David Hedberg. Thank you, C.B. Bettisworth. Our executive producer has been Carla Tanella. I've been your host, Patty Kostelic. Have a nice weekend, and I will talk to you next week. Thank you very much.
You're listening to KUAC-FM in Fairbanks. It's now 1 minute past 12 o'clock and time for the National Press Club.
Support for this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation for reporting on biological resource issues, Mead Data Central for Nexus Research Services, and for election coverage, Carnegie Corporation of New York. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Washington, D.C., National Public Radio presents another in the continuing series of broadcasts from the National Press Club. I'm Frank Stacio, and today's guest speaker is the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Charles Manatt.
Boy, y'all quieted up faster than most of them. Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is John Fogarty. I'm president of the Press Club and the Washington correspondent of the San Francisco Chronicle. I'd like to welcome my fellow club members and their guests seated in the audience today, as well as those of you who are listening to this program over the 303 national public radio stations or watching over the 1,800 cable systems affiliated with C-SPAN, the Cable Satellite Public Affairs Network. Before going any further, I'd like to remind our members of some coming events. Our next newsmaker luncheon will be on Monday, November the 20th, when our guest will be Texas industrialist H. Ross Perot. Mr. Perot headed a commission in Texas that dealt with education, and he will be discussing education reforms that were recently implemented in that state and what their implications are for the United States. I'd like to remind the audience at this point that if you have any questions for our speaker today, and I hope you will, it gets lonely up here without questions, please write them on the cards at your table and pass them up to me. I'll ask as many as time allows. Please write as clearly as you possibly can. Some questions don't get asked simply because I can't read them. I'd now like to introduce the guests at the head table, ask our guests to please stand briefly when their names are read. Also ask the audience, please withhold your applause until I've read all the names. Starting at my left, Jesse Stearns, Stearns News Service, Godfrey Sperling, Christian Science Monitor, Sarah McClendon, McClendon News Service, Ross Mark, London Daily Express, Mrs. Kathy Manatt, wife of the speaker, Judy Grandy, Cleveland Plain Dealer and chairperson of the NPC Speakers Committee, Gene Russell, director of communications of the Democratic National Committee, John Peterson, the Detroit News and the NPC financial secretary. He's also the member of our speakers committee who organized today's luncheon. Susan King, WRC Channel 4, Frank Alkifer, Milwaukee Journal, and a past NPC president, and Bettina Gregory, who's a campaign manager for John Flannery, Democratic candidate for Virginia's 10th congressional, 10th congressional district, and she's a guest of the speaker. I want to thank all of our members of the audience, too, for finding your way to the ballroom. It used to be a little more difficult because of construction. We've now finished. We had a, thank God, it's finished party last Friday night, and I hope that we hope to see you all here often. Just before the Democratic National Convention opened in San Francisco, there was a surprise party for our speaker. Ann Getty threw the party, and Walter Mondale threw the surprise. The surprise was that Mondale had decided to give our speaker's job to Burt Lance. Quote, of all the days, our speaker said at the time, I have no other comment. We're going to do something about it tomorrow. Less than 48 hours later, the Mondale campaign announced that Charles T. Manatt was still chairman of the Democratic National Committee. One of the major mysteries of this political year, at least for me, is how they got Manatt to wipe the smile off his face prior to going to the press conference to announce that he was staying. I think it was a great, great moment of self-control. The victory was a good example of Manatt's tenacity. He spent 4 years and about $75,000 to become DNC chairman. The chairmanship was the culmination of a long climb up the party's ladder of success, leadership. Since becoming chairman, Manatt has added hundreds of thousands of contributors' names to the party's treasury list, changed party primary rules, and supervised the construction of the party's new office headquarters on Capitol Hill. If you believe the national opinion polls, being chairman of the DNC at this time is somewhat like being the captain of the Titanic, the Andrea Doria, and the Lusitania all at once. No doubt Mr. Manatt believes that the party and its national ticket can still surprise the pollsters, the Republican Party, and Ronald Reagan and win the White House. It's my pleasure to give him that opportunity to convince us that this is the case. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the DNC chairman, Chuck Manatt, to the NPC.
Thank you, John, and I have always known and I always will know you're with the Chronicle, not the Examiner. I want the record clear. You represent a newspaper in such a nice town, we ought to have a convention sometime in the town of San Francisco. I think, contrary to some people's thoughts, it will go great. I am delighted today to be with you for a number of reasons. One, apparently the final day occurred when Susan King has finally gotten a membership application for the press club. So I want to say that's one good piece of news. Secondly, having seen the club in the last 4 years, I guess it's sort of been like my period as party chairman of going through a facelift, or whatever you might call it. I am delighted the facelift is nearly completed, and such a pleasure to be here and to be here under this terrific day, kind of a day of summer, or so it seems outside, when we're all feeling good and will continue to. This election, as we all know, is born a number of election turns, unusual things.